The headlines: official figures show Eurozone inflation hit a new record in July as growth in Europe's largest economy, Germany, stagnated in the second quarter of this year. Russia expresses solidarity with China over its stance on Taiwan after Beijing warned Washington not to, quote, play with fire over the island. And a teenage Palestinian boy is killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour, the news on Eurozone economy has been bad for months. Now official data show inflation across the Eurozone has reached another record high. The EU statistics agency Eurostat says Eurozone inflation has climbed to 8.9% in July. That's while the fight against rising prices has raised fears of a recession. Meanwhile, Europe's largest economy, Germany, has experienced a period of stagnation this year. Official statistics say the German economy showed 0% growth in the second quarter of 2022. The global supply chain problems and the fallout of the Ukraine war are among the main contributors to the economic hardships across the Eurozone. Meanwhile, the entire EU has run into difficulties with its energy demands amid the face-off with Russia. That has resulted in a hike in gas prices. Earlier, our correspondent Jerome Hughes told us why the Eurozone inflation continues to hit records. Let's take a listen.
The picture is very bleak, and you know, when we talk about the inflation, I mean, across the Eurozone you have an average inflation, but actually if you delve into each individual country, the inflation is running higher in some countries. You know, it's above 9% in some countries. You know, it's a massive issue, inflation, and we talk about inflation and our viewers are watching now, but actually it means something. It means that the cost of living is going higher and higher. It actually has tangible reaction to people or impact on people. And you have to ask, where is it? Why is it all happening? We have the conflict in Ukraine, which could have been prevented, but it hasn't been prevented. And it's ordinary people. Doesn't matter where you are in society. If you are an average person, you're paying the price. All the indicators suggest that it has to get worse. It has to get worse, because there's no end in sight of the crisis. And the Western powers, all they want to do is try and pile on pressure on Russia, and then it's the ordinary people here who are paying the price.
Russia throws its weight behind China on the Taiwan issue, urging the United States to stick to the One China policy and not to aggravate the circumstances.
We have no problems with upholding the principle of China's sovereignty, and we proceed from the fact that no irritants, no provocations that can aggravate this situation will be undertaken. Our position regarding the One China policy remains unchanged. The United States periodically confirms the same position in words, but in practice, as you know, their deeds do not always correspond to their words.
The Kremlin has also expressed solidarity with China over Taiwan. Spokesman Dmitry Peskov told reporters that Moscow respects China's sovereignty and territorial integrity. He warned against any provocative steps regarding the issue, this after the Chinese president warned his American counterparts in a phone call against a potential visit to the island by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Those who play with fire will eventually get burned. I hope the U.S. side can fully understand that. The United States should abide by the One China principle with regard to Taiwan and ensure that its actions are consistent with its words.
This is the latest in a series of warnings since reports emerged that Pelosi could pay a visit to Taipei in August. Last week, the Financial Times reported China had alarmed the U.S. privately that the move could possibly provoke a military response. Beijing said such a visit would send a wrong signal to separatist forces in Taiwan. It has warned that the U.S. should be held responsible for any serious consequences of Pelosi's planned trip. Beijing is opposed to Washington's growing military and diplomatic ties with Taipei, which China considers as part of its territory. Taiwan says it will continue to develop its close security partnership with Washington. Moscow and Kiev blame each other for a deadly strike on a jail that housed Ukrainian prisoners of war in a town controlled by pro-Russians in Donetsk. Russia accuses Ukraine of hitting the facility with U.S.-made rockets.
A missile strike from a U.S.-made multiple-launch rocket system HIMARS was carried out on a pre-trial detention center in the area of Alenivka, where Ukrainian military prisoners of war, including fighters from the Azov regiment, are being held.
The Russian Defense Ministry called the attack a, quote, egregious provocation designed to prevent Ukrainian soldiers from surrendering. The ministry said 40 people were killed and dozens of others injured in the attack. Ukraine denied carrying out the strike and put the blame on Russia. It said Russian forces conducted the raid to accuse Kiev of committing war crimes. Belarus has recalled its ambassador to Britain in response to what it describes as hostile and unfriendly steps taken by London. The Belarusian Foreign Ministry said in a statement, the UK's policies systematically cause damage to Belarusian citizens and legal entities. The statement was referring to sanctions on Belarusian companies, national airline, and restrictions on its state media. Belarus's foreign ministry said it's not severing ties with London, but downgrading its diplomatic mission to temporary chargé d'affaires. The ministry said it would consider restoration of dialogue with Britain once, quote, responsible politicians appear in the British government. Ties between Minsk and London have been tense for months now. Last week, London introduced new financial, trade, and transport sanctions in response to Minsk's support of Russia over the Ukraine conflict and suppression of 2020 mass election protests. There's no respite for Palestinians from Israeli atrocities as the regime's forces kill another teenager in the occupied West Bank. The slain Palestinian has been identified as 16-year-old Amjad Abu Aliyah. The Palestinian Health Ministry says he died of critical wounds sustained by live bullets in the chest. He was killed near a village northeast of the city of Ramallah. Israel has in recent weeks ramped up attacks on Palestinian towns and cities throughout the West Bank. As a result of those raids, well over 50 Palestinians have been killed in occupied territory since late March. Many more have also been wounded and arrested. And we've talked to our West Bank correspondent, Mona Candio, for more information about the killing of the Palestinian teen by Israeli forces. Let's listen to what she had to say.
A 16-year-old Palestinian teenager, Amjad Abu Aliyah, from the village of Al-Mghayr near Ramallah, was shot dead by Israeli forces, by the fire of Israeli forces and Israeli settlers. This is according to eyewitnesses there. There was an invitation or a call for Palestinians to take part in an anti-Israeli settlement protest, because Israeli settlers there, protected and backed by Israeli forces, continue to storm the Al-Mghayr village on a daily basis, attack Palestinians, throw stones at them, hit them in order to force them leave their lands, because the settlers want to confiscate more lands in the village of Al-Mghayr. So Palestinians were protesting there following the Friday prayers, and Israeli settlers raided again the village of Al-Mghayr, backed and supported by fully armed Israeli forces. And we have to mention that the Israeli settlers themselves are also armed like the Israeli soldiers. They opened fire at Palestinian protesters there, wounding dozens of them.
Activists and the family of slain Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh have gathered in front of the U.S. Congress, calling on Washington to hold Israel accountable for her killing. Abu Akleh was shot dead by Israeli fire in May while she was covering the regime's military raid in the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. International lawyers, Shirin's family, and a group of House representatives have censured the U.S. administration for inaction on the assassination.
My name is Anton Abu Akleh, and Shirin was my little sister. When President Biden was coming to Jerusalem earlier this month, I thought for sure he would meet with us. A U.S. citizen, a prominent journalist, beloved by millions of people, was killed by a highly trained Israeli soldier. President Biden was 10 minutes away. He never came to see us. So we had to come here to Washington with support from a community of wonderful people who share our commitment to justice for Shirin. President Biden still hasn't agreed to meet us. We need him to hear from us directly so that he understands the pain our family and too many other Palestinians have endured. President Biden has the power to make sure that this doesn't happen again. We need him to follow his words with meaningful action. Shireen deserves justice, and our demand remains the same, a U.S. investigation that leads to real accountability.
Reports from the United Nations, the New York Times, CNN, and many others have concluded that Israeli soldiers killed my aunt Shireen. There is no doubt. We want to know who pulled the trigger and why, and we want there to be accountability for the system that gave the green light. Journalists should never be targeted while doing their job, no matter which country they're reporting from.
As is Israel's practice, they try to deflect and to deny responsibility. And in Shireen's case, despite the presence of numerous witnesses, they tried to do the same. Numerous newspapers and organizations had conducted investigations and concluded that an Israeli soldier killed Shireen. Despite all of these reports and despite the promises made, the U.S. has yet to conduct an independent, transparent investigation, nor hold Shireen's killers or the government that killed her responsible. As a result, the family has come here to seek an investigation, to seek justice, to seek accountability for Shireen's murder. It's shocking to me that they had to come here rather than the U.S. administration going to them. They had to come over here to seek justice rather than the other way around.
Every human killed, American or not, deserves justice, Palestinians included, Black folks included. We want answers. We need to ensure that these answers are accurate, that they are transparent, and that they are timely. It has been 2 months since Shireen's death, and we have yet to hold her perpetrators accountable. The State Department released their statements of the summation of the Israeli and PA investigations, but that is not enough, nor is it what our request has been from the beginning.
The U.S. must commit to launching its own credible, independent investigation. I echo the family's call for the Biden administration to have this investigation led by the FBI and the Department of Justice, including the Human Rights and Special Prosecution Section, which are tasked with investigating war crimes against U.S. citizens.
Iran's Minister of Industry, Mine and Trade, Seyed Reza Fatemi Amin, has attended the 15th Iran-Belarus Joint Economic Commission in the city of Minsk. He joined us earlier to talk about the summit. Fatemi Amin says Tehran and Minsk agreed to increase their trade volume to $1 billion.
We have negotiated on $1 billion of toys, a volume of $1 billion. Right now, the capacity of toys between the two sides is $40 million, and that's because the connections have not been very good, but we are going to improve it. Belarus has very good capacities in creating machines, including agricultural and industrial machines. On the other hand, we have capacities in mines in Iran, and we agreed for Belarus to provide mine machines for us. On the other hand, Iran has capacities in medicine and auto production. And yesterday, an Iranian company launched its activities in Belarus to produce medicine. Belarus is one of the countries of the Eurasian Union. It's one of the member states. Iran also has started the process of joining Eurasian Union. Right now, we are sending products to this union. We have a cooperation. We're continuing our negotiations, and we hope that in the near future we will be a definite, a permanent member state of the Eurasian Union.
Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's visit to Paris and his meeting with French President Emmanuel Macron has sparked outrage. The widow of murdered Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi slammed Macron for welcoming the, quote, executioner of her fiancé Atis Cengiz said all international investigations carried out so far recognize the Saudi Crown Prince's responsibility in the gruesome murder. Three rights groups have called on French authorities to open a criminal investigation into Mohammed bin Salman. They filed a legal complaint with a Paris court saying the royal should not have immunity from prosecution for being the Saudi head of state. Bin Salman arrived in Paris on Thursday after a stopover in Greece. Khashoggi was killed in 2018 by Saudi agents inside the country's consulate in Istanbul. Well, that's a wrap for now, but do stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Research published recently warns that forever chemicals used in everyday products could lead to tens of billions of dollars in medical costs in the United States, globally infamous for its for-profit healthcare system. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jessica Corbett, journalist. This article is published under the heading Study Ties Forever Chemicals Exposure to Billions in U.S. Health Costs. Stay tuned for more. Research published recently warns that forever chemicals used in everyday products could lead to tens of billions of dollars in medical costs in the United States, globally infamous for its for-profit healthcare system. The new study, published online in the journal Exposure and Health, focuses on per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, a class of over 4,700 manufactured chemicals that persist in the human body and environment for long periods. Because of their use in everything from firefighting foam to food packaging to furniture, the substances have been found in drinking water, soil, and people across the U.S. The researchers, led by Vladislav Obeskov of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, calculated how many Americans were likely exposed to PFAS in 2018 using blood samples from the U.S. National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, then examined the studies from the past decade of diseases tied to the chemicals. PFAS have been connected to various health issues, including multiple types of cancer, childhood obesity, and damage to immune and reproductive systems. The study estimates the economic burden of 13 medical conditions that may result from daily PFAS exposure. Our findings add to the substantial and still mounting body of evidence suggesting that exposure to PFAS is harming our health and undermining the economy, said study co-author Linda G. Kahn, an assistant professor at New York University Langone Health, in a statement. The researchers determined that 13 conditions potentially resulting from PFAS exposure could cost Americans $5.5 billion to $63 billion over the lifetime of the current population. Among the five conditions with the strongest connections to the chemicals, the biggest contributors to the economic toll were childhood obesity, followed by hypothyroidism in women. Dr. Leonardo Trasande, another co-author and NYU Langone professor, said that our results strongly support the recent decision by the Environmental Protection Agency to lower the safe, allowable level of these substances in water. The federal agency last month took what green groups called baby steps on drinking water contamination by common PFAS, issuing four health advisories to lowering the levels for PFOA and PFOS, and two, establishing new guidance for Gen X and PFBS. Consumer Reports senior staff scientist Michael Hansen said at the time that EPA's move is a major victory for science and represents an important first step to ensure everyone has access to safe drinking water, but also called on the agency to adopt legally binding standards. Alongside the new advisories in June, EPA Administrator Michael Regan announced a new grant program to invest $1 billion to reduce PFAS and other contaminants in drinking water. Based on our estimates, the cost of eradicating contamination and replacing this class of chemical with safer alternatives is ultimately justified when considering the tremendous economic and medical risks of allowing them to persist in the environment. Trasanda said recently, adding that his research team now plans to study the long-term risks of PFAS in the U.S.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
Ziyara of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Now we find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim's life, in all of its various dimensions, is distinguished in a few things. First of all, he is distinguished in the firmness and the strength for which he stood up for when it came to the right, to truth, to haq. We also find his steadfastness in front of all kinds of events, trials and tribulations, good or bad. And we also see Imam Musa al-Kadhim's luminous behavior, his actions, his morals, and his ethics, of which no deviation or crookedness has ever been reported. And finally, the life of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam is marked by balance. It is in harmony with that of the life of the Prophet Muhammad. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام تستحب عرامة الغلام في صغره ليكون حليما في كبره.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, "It is recommended to discipline a boy in his childhood in order that he be clement as an adult."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, the beautiful dialogues and conversations of the divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, are these conversations which surely make us think twice about what we know in our life. In one such instance, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was speaking with his companions about the rights and the characteristics and the essence of a believer. In today's day and age, we find that there are so many Muslim brothers and sisters all across the world whom are under oppression. They are being oppressed. Their basic human rights are not being fulfilled, namely in the countries and the places such as Palestine and Nigeria and Iraq and Syria, Yemen, the Islamic Republic of Iran, for example, who is under severe sanctions for almost four decades now. Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam here in this dialogue, he says that the believer is the brother of another believer on the side of both his mother and his father, though they are not born by those parents. Such a profound and a beautiful relationship that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam has explained to us, that one believer to another believer, it is like there are two brothers from the same parents, even though they are not physically born from the same parents. Now, if we were to look at each other in this manner, surely not only would our relationships change, our communities, our societies, and eventually even the world would change. If we looked at another believer, at another mu'min, at another good Muslim in this manner, right? Then we would care about what is happening to the Palestinian brothers and sisters. We would care about what is happening to the Yemeni brothers and sisters. And if physically we cannot do anything, then at least verbally we should be able to help and support these brothers and sisters from our parents, even though they are not born from them. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
When it comes to the analysis of the life of the Imam, one begins to understand that there were a number of challenges that were posed in his lifetime. What kind of challenges? He went through five Abbasid caliphs. Who were they? As-Saffah, Al-Mansur, Al-Hadi, Al-Mahdi, and finally Harun al-Abbasi. And during each and every caliphate of these particular five tyrants, the Imam Salamullahi Alayhi adopted a number of strategies and became very much influential within the community and within the Muslim Ummah. One thing that the Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim Salawatullahi wa Salamu Alayhi was very much distinguished at the onset was the fact that he wanted to purify the intentions as well as correct some of the moral indecencies that were prevalent within the society at that time. In which way? Imam alayhi salam would walk past a house in which music is being played. A servant outside is bringing the rubbish or the garbage. He asks her, the owner of the house that the music inside is being played, is he a slave or is he a master? She responds back by saying, indeed, he is a master. Imam alayhi salam would say to her, if he was a slave, he would have respected his master. And he moves on. The lady goes back. The man inside by the name of Bishr says to her, who did you speak to? She describes this man that she saw. She says he has thafanat. Thafanat means excess skin on his forehead. She says to him that he was so skinny when he was standing, I could see the wind somewhat moving his body and his abba. He immediately recognizes that this is a noble individual, a virtuous man. Tell me, what is it that he said? She responds back by saying that he said, if the man inside the house was a slave, he would have respected his master. That statement hit hard in the heart of this man, Bishr, who runs barefooted to catch Imam Musa ibn Ja'far and says to him, Sayyidi wa Mawlai, halli min tawbah.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
The Assange persecution is the greatest threat to Western press freedoms in years. It is also a shining monument to the fraud of American and British self-depictions, says Glenn Greenwald, author, in an article published under the heading, The UK's decision to extradite Assange shows why the US-UK's freedom lectures are a farce. The 11-year persecution of Julian Assange was extended and escalated recently. The British Home Secretary Priti Patel approved the U.S. extradition request to send Julian Assange to Virginia to stand trial on 18 felony charges under the 1917 Espionage Act and other statutes in connection with 2010 publication by WikiLeaks of thousands of documents showing widespread corruption, deceit and war crimes by American and British authorities along with their close dictatorial allies in the West Asia-North Africa region. This decision is unsurprising. It has been obvious for years that the US and UK are determined to destroy Assange as punishment for his journalism exposing their crimes, yet it nonetheless further highlights the utter sham of American and British sermons about freedom, democracy, and a free press. Those performative, self-glorifying spectacles are constantly deployed to justify these two countries' interference in and attacks on other nations and to allow their citizens to feel a sense of superiority about the nature of their governments. After all, if the US and UK stand for freedom and against tyranny, who could possibly oppose their wars and interventions in the name of advancing such lofty goals and noble values? Having reported on the Assange case for years on countless occasions, laid out the detailed background that led Assange and the US to this point, there is thus no need to recount all of that again. Those interested can read the granular trajectory of this persecution here and there. Suffice to say, Assange, without having been convicted of any crime other than bail jumping for which he long ago served out his 50-week sentence, has been in effective imprisonment for more than a decade. In 2012, Ecuador granted Assange legal asylum from political persecution. It did so after the Swedish government refused to pledge that it would not exploit the WikiLeaks founder's travel to Sweden to answer sex assault accusations as a pretext to turn him over to the US, fearing, what of course ended up happening, that the US was determined to do everything possible to drag Assange back to US soil, despite his not being a US citizen and never having spent more than a few days on US soil, and intending to pressure their long-time submissive Swedish allies to turn him over once he was on Swedish soil. The government of Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa concluded Assange's core civic rights were being denied and thus gave him refuge in the tiny Ecuadorian embassy in London. The classic reason political asylum exists. When Trump officials led by CIA Director Mike Pompeo bullied Correa's meek successor, ex-President Lenin Moreno, to withdraw that asylum in 2019, the London police entered the embassy, arrested Assange, and put him in the high-security Belmarsh prison, which the BBC in 2004 dubbed the British Guantanamo, where he has remained ever since. After the lowest-level British court in early 2021 rejected the US extradition request on the ground that Assange's physical and mental health could not endure the US prison system, Assange has lost every subsequent appeal. Last year, he was permitted to marry his fiancée, the British human rights lawyer Stella Morris Assange, who is also the mother of their two young children. An extremely unusual unanimity among press freedom and civil liberties groups was formed in early 2021 to urge the Biden administration to cease its prosecution of Assange. But Biden officials, despite spending the Trump years masquerading as press freedom advocates, ignored them. The recent UK Home Secretary's decision, characteristically subservient and obedient of the British when it comes to the demands of the US, does not mean that Assange's presence on US soil is imminent. Under British law, Assange has the right to pursue a series of appeals contesting the Home Secretary's decision and will likely do so. Given that the British judiciary has more or less announced in advance their determination to follow the orders of their American masters, it is difficult to see how these further proceedings will have any effect other than to delay the inevitable. But putting oneself in Assange's position, it is easy to see why he is so eager to avoid extradition to the US for as long as possible. The Espionage Act of 1917 is a nasty and repressive piece of legislation. It was designed by Woodrow Wilson and his band of authoritarian progressives to criminalize dissent against Wilson's decision to involve the US in the First World War. It was used primarily to imprison anti-war leftists such as Eugene Debs, as well as anti-war religious leaders such as Joseph Franklin Rutherford, for the crime of publishing a book condemning Wilson's foreign policy. One of the most insidious despotic innovations of the Obama administration was to repurpose and revitalize the Wilson-era Espionage Act as an all-purpose weapon to punish whistleblowers who denounced Obama's policies. The Obama Justice Department under Attorney General Eric Holder prosecuted more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act of 1917 than all previous administrations combined. In fact, three times as many as all prior presidents combined. One whistleblower charged by Obama officials under that law is NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, who in 2013 revealed mass domestic spying of precisely the kind that Obama's Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, now of CNN, falsely denied conducting when testifying to the Senate, which led to legislative curbs enacted by the U.S. Congress and which courts have ruled unconstitutional and illegal. What makes this law so insidious is that, by design, it is almost impossible for the government to lose. As detailed in a Washington Post op-ed when the indictment was first revealed, arguing why it poses the greatest threat to press freedoms in the West in years, this 1917 law is written as a strict liability statute, meaning that the defendant is not only guilty as soon as there is proof that they disclosed classified information without authorization, but they are also barred from raising a justification defense, meaning they cannot argue to the jury of their peers that it was not only permissible but morally necessary to disclose that information because of the serious wrongdoing and criminality it revealed on the part of the nation's most powerful political officials. That 1917 law, in other words, is written to offer only show trials but not fair trials. No person in their right mind would willingly submit to prosecution and life imprisonment in the harshest American penitentiaries under an indictment brought under this fundamentally corrupted law. Whatever else one might think of Assange, there is simply no question that he is one of the most consequential, pioneering, and accomplished journalists of his time. One could easily make the case that he occupies the top spot by himself. And that, of course, is precisely why he is in prison, because just like free speech, free press guarantees in the US and UK exist only on a piece of parchment and in theory. Citizens are free to do journalism as long as it does not disturb or anger or impede real power centers. Employees of the Washington Post and CNN are free to say what they want as long as what they are saying is approved and directed by the CIA, or the content of their reporting advances the interest of the Pentagon's sprawling war machine. Real journalists often face threats of prosecution, imprisonment, or even murder, and sometimes even mean tweets. Much of the American corporate media class has ignored Assange's persecution or even cheered it precisely because he shames them, serving as a vivid mirror to show them what real journalism is and how they are completely bereft of it. And the American and British governments have successfully exploited the petty jealousies and insecurities of their failed, vapid, and pointless media servants to get away with imposing the single greatest threat to press freedom in the West without much protest at all. Free speech and press freedoms do not exist in reality in the US or in the UK. They are merely rhetorical instruments to propagandize their domestic population and justify and ennoble the various wars and other forms of subversion they constantly wage in other countries in the name of upholding values they themselves do not support. The Julian Assange persecution is a great personal tragedy, a political travesty, and a grave danger to basic civic freedoms. But it is also a bright and enduring monument to the fraud and deceit that lies at the heart of these two governments' depictions of who and what they are.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a heralder of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me a your mercy, send me your peace, so I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very beautiful and a very noble hadith which has been narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. And this hadith is about the blessing of memorizing things, memorizing knowledge, memorizing verses of the Holy Quran, memorizing hadith. You know, memorizing in and of itself is something very good and profitable and blessed. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, and this tradition has been related from Al-Mufaddal, one of the companions of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. You know, there's a book called Tawheed-e-Mufaddal, in which Imam Sadiq alayhi salam talks about the wonders of creation and mentions them to this person. The same person says that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, "Have you ever thought what man's state would have been if from among all his traits he missed the faculty of memory?" Right, so this hadith, it talks about, in reality also, the blessing of the faculty of memory. Why memory is such an important thing and good. The Imam questions this person and asks him, what would happen if a person didn't have this faculty? The Imam says, and how many problems he would have suffered in his affairs, his livelihood and his experiences, if he did not remember what was to his benefit and what was to his detriment, what he had taken and what he had given, and what he had seen and what he had heard. He would not have learned the way even if he had traversed the same path countless times, or retained a science even if he had kept learning it all his life. Right? You know, we have short-term memory, we have long-term memory. A lot of times, people who are hidden get hit in the head or experience a fall and, something happens to them, right? A lot of times their short-term memory or their long-term memory is affected, and great problems occur for such people, right? We can learn the blessing and the importance of, you know, this faculty if we look at such individuals. The Imam says, he would not have learned the way even if he had traversed the same path countless times, or retained a science even if he had kept learning it all his life, or professed a religion, or benefited by an experience, or been able to take a lesson from anything that had happened. Truly, he would have lost the very basis of his humanity. Right? All of the person's efforts and everything that he would have done would have come to naught, and it would be impossible for him, to live a normal life, right? In similar connection to this topic, the Prophet ﷺ said regarding memorization, three things eliminate forgetfulness. So memorization in and of itself, this faculty is good. It's also necessary for us to cultivate it, to make it better, right? The Prophet said three things eliminate forgetfulness and incite remembrance: recitation of the Holy Quran, brushing the teeth, and finally, fasting. If we want to increase our memories, let's say that something happens to our memories, they become weaker, we can improve them by these three things. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the blessing of the faculty of memory and what helps increase it, in the words of Imam Sadiq and the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma
على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.